Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Canadian poet and novelist Margaret Atwood once cringed when called a science fiction writer. In The Handmaid's Tale, in Oryx and Crake, in The Year of the Flood, she has speculated powerfully about dystopian futures. But science fiction? Maybe no thanks. Now she's had second thoughts, and she's sharing them about science fiction and its power to convey and shape our understanding of the world. This hour on Point, Margaret Atwood on sci-fi. Joining me now from New York is Margaret Atwood, Booker Prize-winning author of more than 50 books of fiction, nonfiction, poetry. Her new book, exploring her relationship with sci-fi and ours too, is In Other Worlds, SF and the Human Imagination. Margaret Atwood, thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure, Tom.
It's just terrific to have you. What an interesting book, an interesting kind of grappling with your own, as you say, tangled relationship with science fiction. What was it about that tag early on that sort of put you off, Margaret?
Well, I don't think it put me off. I think it's more like truth in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if I open the box of cornflakes, I want there to be cornflakes in it. And not, for instance, pebbles. So science fiction usually means to people that it's going to involve other planets, other dimensions of time, for instance, time travel like H.G. Wells' Time Machine,
mm-hmm.
Alien beings coming to Earth or people going to places where they are. And those things are not in any of my books. So although some people class, for instance, 1984 and The War of the Worlds both as science fiction, I think there's a real difference because in 1984, things in it could really happen. In fact, a lot of them had really happened. The War of the Worlds, we're very unlikely to see large tin cans descending on Earth with Martians coming out of them. So I don't want somebody to pick up a book and think that there's something in it that isn't. That's all.
And yet, when Ursula K. Le Guin, to whom you dedicate this new book, Margaret Atwood, when she spoke up and said, "Hey, Margaret, don't distance yourself so vigorously from science fiction. You're not as far as you think, and besides, you know, we're not bad company." You seem to be writing partly in response to that kind of challenge, if I read you
well,
right.
Well, she was being a bit naughty.
Yes? How?
Yes.
Why?
Well, when I went out to Portland and we did an event together, it turns out that she, too, makes a distinction between one kind of book and another kind of book, and that what I mean by science fiction, she thinks of as being speculative fiction, and what I mean by science fiction, she would call fantasy. In other words, she knows that there's a difference between books in which the things really could happen and books in which they really could not happen.
Here's a little bit
with dragons mm-hmm. and wizards would not happen, for instance.
Would not happen.
Would not happen, no.
But yet our imagination roams kind of freely over these boundaries. And here's a little bit of Ursula Le Guin. This is with Bill Moyers in the year 2000. Here she's kind of dismissing, Margaret Atwood, the boundaries within the genre of what she's calling maybe imaginative fiction.
There's sci-fi and there's science fiction and there's spec fic. The speculative fiction, they all have the initials SF, and we all know what they're talking about. And it is, I think, one of the liveliest genres of fiction. Science fiction, one of its differences from fantasy, to me, is that it doesn't contradict science. But it goes on and invents just as freely as fantasy does otherwise.
Ursula Le Guin in the year 2000 with Bill Moyers. So here you are, Margaret Atwood. You've given a series of speeches at Emory University. You've got a lot of that in this new book, In Other Worlds, SF and the Human Imagination. And however you classify your own work, this is clearly a very big, deep embrace of the work that science fiction does. And interestingly, you say, in some ways, our appetite for it has grown for science fiction as myth has kind of depleted and receded from our lives?
Well, I think science fiction, or let us call it wonder tales, you know, you can have a big banner with wonder tales, and all of those things fit under that. It has stepped in as our ability to write such things as, for instance, Paradise Lost has receded, so that you can still have on Planet X a lot of the things that once upon a time you could have in a depiction of the world that included heaven, hell, and human life in the middle, complete with talking devils and flying angels. You're unlikely to have those nowadays, although they are popping back here and there, but it's less plausible, much less, it's much harder to have them on planet Earth. And even when somebody like C.S. Lewis put them in, he called them something else.
You've got this interesting observation that in myth and even in religion, humans play a great big part, and then along comes science. And science is kind of, it can kind of take or leave human beings. There's a lot more than just human life going on in the cosmos, and that leaves people feeling not very comforted, kind of lonely, without that central role for them. How does science fiction respond to that discomfort in being pushed off stage?
Okay, well, both religious versions and scientific versions, they're both stories. You know, science has its story, so, and religion has its story. So how did the world begin? God spoke it into being, or there was a Big Bang. What is the place of human beings in the universe? They're central. No, they're just a kind of biological accident. So which story do you like better? Which makes you feel happier and more comforted?
The one you're in the middle of, or the one you may not be in at all, and the answer seems pretty clear to you.
Well, it's pretty clear to a lot of people. You know, the science story isn't very cozy. It doesn't make you feel all warm and cuddly.
You're not Adam and Eve. You're just a collection of molecules.
Well, sort of, but also there's no big, we hope, benevolent being taking an interest in us in the science story. And we kind of like the idea that there might be a big benevolent being taking an interest in us.
So as part of science fiction's appeal is that it brings humans back into that science narrative of the cosmos?
No, I think it brings them back into the religious narrative of the cosmos.
What do you mean by that?
But with scientific trappings. You know, you're always running into people with extrasensory perceptions and superpowers and people who know better than you do, and people are bigger than you, people are more powerful than you in science fiction. So there's something up there in the sky that isn't just rocks.
What is it?
Don't know whether you saw, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind or E.T. or
yes,
any of those. Well, so from out of the sky comes something alien but benevolent. It does it not.
It may be benevolent. It may not be benevolent, but at least there's something else out there.
Yeah, in the 50s it was not benevolent.
Right.
Very much not benevolent, but that was sort of code for, you know, communists that were going to come out of the sky and do bad things to your head.
Science fiction has evolved in really interesting ways over the years. You remind us that Jules Verne, for example, was really upset by the way H.G. Wells twisted science fiction off in a new direction. What was Jules Verne unhappy about?
Well, first of all, there was no tag called science fiction in those days. The forms were so new that people didn't know quite what to call them, and some people called them scientific romances. Science fiction didn't appear as a term until the late 1920s, early 1930s. So what Jules Verne thought he was doing was writing stories about things that really could happen, that had submarines in them and going around the world in a balloon. And H.G. Wells comes along with something completely new, such as the time machine or the War of the Worlds with Martians and great big canisters. And Jules Verne was horrified by this. He said, "Mais il en vont." But he's making things up.
Yes. And his thought was this should be a kind of exercise in projection of where we might
yes,
one day go.
Yes, he thought, that's right, how, where the world might go. And people were doing a huge amount of that in the 19th century. It's just filled with utopian fiction, how the world is going to be in the future, what the perfect society would be like. And all we have to do is, and here's how we rearrange things to make it much better. And there were so many of those. There are literally thousands of them in the 19th century.
Utopian then, often dystopian now. So which camp are you in, Jules Verne or H.G. Wells? Do you respect the boundary of what could be? Do you care?
I would put myself in the line of descent that comes from Jules Verne, only because that's the kind of book that I can write. I cannot write the other kind of book, although I greatly enjoy reading the other kind of book.
Martians coming down from the heavens, probably not in a Margaret Atwood story, but really interesting takes on where we may all be soon or in the future. They're in abundance. She wrote The Handmaid's Tale, Oryx and Craig, The Year of the Flood, and much more. She joins us today. Her new book is In Other Worlds. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the essence, the heart of science fiction, about what science fiction does with the great poet and novelist Margaret Atwood. Here's Arthur C. Clarke. This is all the way back in 1964, sci-fi visionary Arthur C. Clarke, who famously predicted communication satellites decades before they actually came around and much more, talking about how difficult it can be to try to write convincingly about the future.
Trying to predict the future is a discouraging and hazardous occupation, because the prophet invariably falls between two stools. If his predictions sound at all reasonable, you can be quite sure that in 20 or at most 50 years, the progress of science and technology has made him seem ridiculously conservative. On the other hand, if by some miracle a prophet could describe the future exactly as it was going to take place, his predictions would sound so absurd, so far-fetched, that everybody would laugh him to scorn.
Arthur C. Clarke in 1964. Margaret Atwood joins us from New York City. Margaret, you're hearing that. Do you sympathize with what Arthur Clarke's talking about there, the danger of sort of falling between what might be and what will never be?
Well, if you think that the aim of this kind of book is to predict the future, you're probably doomed, because there isn't the future. There are an infinite number of possible futures, and you're very unlikely to hit on the one that's going to come true in every detail. Some such writers have predicted bits of the future. Edward Bellamy, looking backwards, nailed credit cards, kind of. But he's right in that there's so much going on in science and technology that you're not going to be able to pinpoint it and track it in a book and get it right.
You pay plenty of attention to science. You write a lot in your speculative fictions, if you will, about social circumstances as well. I mean, in Oryx and Craig 2003, you wrote so much about social inequality and, you know, genetic technology, climate change, apocalypse. Are you trying, when you write that kind of book, are you trying to steer toward a moral lesson, a warning, a danger sign? How do you conceive of a book?
Well, I think
book
these
like that?
Kinds of books function as blueprints. For instance, if you were going to build a house, you would presumably have a plan of it ahead of time, so you can look at the plan and say, is this the house I want to live in? So by taking certain trends present with us today and taking them just a bit further, you can produce a blueprint of not the future house, but a possible future house. And you can say, is that where we want to live? Do we want to live in that kind of world?
Does it, that's a kind of a, it may be a blueprint, but in terms of what you might want to build, it's often a negative imprint, right? I mean, do you build a plan for action by describing the negative option?
I think you can build a plan for evasion. You know, okay. let's not live in that one. Let's wait until maybe we see something better, or maybe the one we're in right now will do just fine. In the 19th century, mm-hmm. they produced lots and lots and lots of blueprints of perfect societies, and then we saw in the 20th century a couple of these blueprints being put into action. And there is always a catch-22 with such things, which is that what do you do with the people who don't fit your blueprint? And what mm-hmm. do you do with the people who disagree with your blueprint?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you start eliminating them one way or another. So we had the Russian Revolution, and then we had the Third Reich, and then we had Pol Pot's Cambodia, and a number of others, and that they were all based on utopian visions.
And ended up with mass killings.
Yeah, absolutely. We know how to really improve things, but first we have to get rid of these other people that are in the way.
Mm. Margaret Atwood is with us. Her new book is In Other Worlds, SF, as in science fiction, and the human imagination. Margaret, we've got a lot of callers for you. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Mike is calling. Hi, Mike, you're on the air with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ms. Atwood. This is an absolute pleasure to be able to talk to you. Just where the conversation was just now going is exactly what I was thinking about. And I know it's a little, obviously it's a television side of it, but Rod Serling, and I know Gene Roddenberry to a certain extent, was saying that they could use, in the guise of science fiction, they could talk more and address social issues such as racism and the Vietnam War, that they couldn't have addressed those issues point blank at that time in the medium that they were writing for. I just wanted to get comments from Ms. Atwood on that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, sure. That's absolutely true. And I was a friend of Judith Merrill. I don't know whether you remember her, but she was a science fiction writer of that same generation.
Mm-hmm.
And she said exactly the same thing. And for those of you who are interested, her collection, which is called the Merrill Collection, is in Toronto Public Library on College Street. They have a big SF collection.
Our listener Dan writes online, good science fiction is like a three-course meal for the imagination, fueling dreams and desires for better and bigger things than the present may provide for us. It's a creation engine for hope and longing for greater things. Now, maybe he's right, but you've got some interesting writing here, thinking on Bill McKibben and folks who are worried about bigger and greater and thinking maybe we need alternative visions entirely of what means progress.
Well, any piece of technology, whether it's bioengineering or digital or anything like that, they're all tools. And tools are morally neutral. They can be used for what we might consider to be good ends, but they can equally be used for what we might consider to be bad ends. So anytime you open the box and let another one out, you're always running a risk that somebody's going to take that tool and use it in a way that you did not intend. What Bill McKibben was writing about and what I'm writing about in relation to him is the push for human immortality and human perfection by means of genetic engineering.
This is in his book, Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So the big question about immortality has always been, what are we going to do when we get there? what is it going to be like to think, well, basically I'm immortal, so how am I going to spend the weekend? There is that problem, but there's also the problem you can make somebody biologically immortal, but that will not stop them from being squashed by a falling piano, or indeed eliminated by a lot of people who resent their immortality.
And that's an issue that's very much in the streets right now with Occupy Wall Street and all the rest. I mean, you've written about who gets the immortality and who doesn't.
Yeah, it would only be rich people, I'm afraid, to begin with.
To begin with. Yes,
and to begin with might take quite a long time. Mm. So there are going to be an awful lot of other people who aren't too keen on this idea of a very few chosen people being immortal.
Do you still see us on that path, the one that Bill kind of warns of and you've written sort of apocalyptically about?
Well, genetic engineering is now a fact. You know, we can do it. So what are we going to do with it? And as I say, any tool can be used for good or for bad. The other problem about genetically engineering human beings The good part is that you could eliminate a lot of inherited diseases. The bad part is that people would start trying to design their babies according to their ideas or somebody's ideas of what perfection is. And it is a conundrum, because how can an imperfect being, such as a human being, decide what is perfect for other human beings? Are we going to get, from the scientists, are we going to get a lot of boy-designed human beings who strangely resemble the scientists, and a lot of girl-designed human beings who strangely resemble beautiful blondes with a weakness for scientists?
Yeah.
Is that going to be the perfect vision of the future?
Your sex pixies, I think you had at one time. Meredith in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Meredith, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that I'm a big fan of Ms. Atwood, and I am currently at college in a class, Introduction to Science Fiction. And we've had to read a lot of books by many famous authors, including Ursula Le Guin. And I just wanted to ask Ms. Atwood what other authors inspired her when she was writing her novel.
Great. Thanks, Meredith. Margaret?
Well, I was an early reader of George Orwell, and also an early reader of Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And also quite a few ones that you might not know. I don't know whether you're reading any John Wyndham, but he was big in the 50s. And Ray Bradbury I read very early, too, as they were coming out. So there's a sort of an H.G. Wells, of course. I read all of those. Moving to more modern times, I have a big piece on Ursula Le Guin in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And other people that I read along the way. There's one that people don't seem to know very well, which is called Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, which I think is pretty well written. Is that enough?
That's a pretty good list. And Meredith, I hope you put it right on your reading list. You mentioned Ridley and Brave New World both. Ridley Scott, we're just reading in the last few weeks, is thinking about coming out with a new version of Brave New World with Leonardo DiCaprio, who apparently owns the rights to that.
Now, what will he play?
I'm not sure how it would all play out or if it will play out, but I'm just curious about what you make of when science fiction jumps to the movies, as it has again and again and again. Does it keep its essential form, or do the movies turn it in some predictable direction?
I think you have to be very careful about how you make those movies, because they're either very, very good, like Blade Runner,
Ridley Scott's,
or they're just howlers. You know, they're just so funny. And I watched a lot of 50s B-movies that were made on very low budgets, and some of them have become cult classics. They're so bad. So you have to be very careful when you're trying to depict non-existent things. But now with computer technology, you can do a really pretty good job of it. I don't know whether you saw Avatar with the 3D specs.
Of course, me and a billion other people.
You and a billion other people. It did create a complete, solid-looking 3D world, which was very convincing.
Do you think that takes us further into the science fiction writer's imagination when that sort of visual depiction becomes possible?
Well, I think it does. If you do it well, it can be very compelling. It's like walking into a Hieronymus Bosch painting,
yeah,
or a little further along into one of the, obviously taking drugs, Victorian fairy painters.
Mm-hmm.
His pictures are quite hallucinogenic.
And there you are. Walter in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks for calling, Walter. You're on the air with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a science fiction writer myself, and I've been a fan of Margaret Atwood ever since I read The Handmaid's Tale many years ago.
Amazing book.
I think I had a run-in with Margaret's nephew on a bus in Canada some years ago. He had a violin case with him, and we had a long conversation about Margaret's books, which was kind of a good way to pass the time.
Great. But
I've always been very interested in writing a dystopian type of fiction, and my novels cover that same territory. And something that I've just found is that as terrible things happen in the world, sometimes reality outstrips the fantasy you create, so that it kind of becomes a matter of continually upping the ante. And so I was wondering what Margaret, how she deals with that.
It's a great question. Margaret?
Oh, there is that problem. But the other problem is that if you pile on the gore too much, the reader just turns off. No?
Of course, it must be more than gore. It must be what different expressions of technology or science or how humans respond to them.
Yeah, I think the caller was mm-hmm. talking about catastrophes, mm-hmm. possibly.
And here we are. I mean, I found myself wondering, as you describe, how science fiction kind of lays out what models, molds, visions to help us engage, think about and engage with the world, about those who push even further out. I mean, a lot of your books have dealt with things that we can understand, what you're seeing and how you're projecting forward. You know, what about those who work right out on the edge where our ability to even understand what the writer's talking about begins to slip away, Margaret?
Well, I think that's a communications problem. If you can visualize it, you ought to be able to write it in such a way that somebody unfamiliar with it can understand it.
Is there a science fiction future that's so little, we have so little purchase on now that it just should be off limits, you know, that it's so kind of sketchy that we just got a few neutrino signals?
Them's fighting words.
Are they?
You never tell writers that there's anything right. off limits.
No, but it may be just simply beyond the ability to put into that comprehensible.
You know, you try, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But you can't tell people not to try.
And I guess no one would. I'd be curious to know who you think may have gone off the map in trying. Have you ever felt near the edge of the map, near incomprehensibility?
Well, as I say, things can quite quickly turn into comedy. Have you watched Fantastic Voyage lately?
It's been a long time.
That's the one in which they miniaturized them.
I think Raquel Welch in somebody's bloodstream is my sort of
that's right.
Very
Raquel
early
Welch in somebody's bloodstream. They're trying to get into the brain to remove a brain clot so this guy can pop back into conscious life and tell them the secret of the universe. There's a bad scientist on the submarine, and it is like one of those fairy stories in which people get made very small, but at midnight they're going to get big again.
Right, right.
So they have to get the submarine
get out
of the bloodstream
right.
before midnight, otherwise it's going to explode.
Raquel Welch is going to blow up your heart.
Well, Raquel Welch almost buys
anyway,
it in the
right.
inner ear.
Yes,
she gets white corpuscles all over her chest
right.
and her throat. And the other guy says, oh, we have to help her. We have to help her. They rush over and start pulling them off her chest.
Yeah.
She's strangling to death. Anyway, you'll be happy to know that when they get to the brain, it's full of gray gauze. Which explains that hangover you had just
I guess.
The other day.
A close call out on the maybe absurd edge. On the other hand, here we are decades later doing all kinds of things, probing into the human body one way
there
or another.
There are little nanobots
yes, exactly.
that you can send to the bloodstream, but they do not look like Raquel Welch.
No, not yet. Maybe in that science fiction future if we don't watch out. Margaret Atwood, please stand by. The new book is In Other Worlds, SF and the Human Imagination. Here from Avatar, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about science fiction and what it does with Margaret Atwood. All kinds of comments online here. Terry writes, sci-fi is harder to misinterpret maybe than more, I was tempted to say more literary offerings, but we'll talk about what's literary and what's not. Jeff in Salem, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ms. Atwood. I guess I just had a comment. That I'm a big science fiction fan. I kind of think that science fiction might be the ultimate narcissistic art form, because in all science fiction, there's this underpinning of humanity being able to accomplish or overcome any obstacle they view as an obstacle set before them. Ms. Atwood Atwood was talking about immortality earlier, and regardless of whether you would view immortality as a positive or negative, any fictional book that has that theme in it, there's this underpinning of the idea that immortality is overcome.
But what about when it becomes so dystopian, lately, Jeff? Do you still feel all that confidence in overcoming anything?
That's one of the fun things about science fiction is you can depart from reality and not be so weighed down by what's actually going on.
Or maybe rolled right over by it. What about the ultimate narcissism in science fiction, Margaret, more than any other genre?
Well, the author does have more total control of that world than you have either in historical fiction, where you have to observe real things that actually happened and try to be accurate, or writing about the present-day world. Again, there's a reality out there. So when you're writing a separate world, as long as you're internally consistent with it, you do have more control than you would have with other kinds of fiction. Is that narcissistic, or is it just being a total control freak?
Well, right. Or sometimes, though, it's not exactly suggesting that we have a rosy future. We can overcome all. I mean, a lot of yours is pointed in other directions entirely. There's a story, Time Capsule, found on the dead planet, which is included in a new collection of short stories, I'm With the Bears. And in there, you talk about how you're taking us through stages of humanity, and I guess it's sci-fi. This is because this is the last communication in an unearthed time capsule. And you say, first we created gods on Earth, then we created money. I wonder if you could read a bit for us from that point, if you'd be good enough, Margaret.
First, I have to find it. Let me see where it is. Right.
This is...
Okay, so first we created money. In the second age, we created money. This money was also made of shining metals. It had two faces. On one side was a severed head, that of a king or some other noteworthy person. On the other face was something else, something that would give us comfort, a bird, a fish, a fur-bearing animal. This was all that remained of our former gods. The money was small in size, and each of us would carry some of it with him every day, as close to the skin as possible. We could not eat this money, wear it, or burn it for warmth, but as if by magic, it could be changed into such things. The money was mysterious, and we were in awe of it. If you had enough of it, it was said, you would be able to fly.
Would be able to. And on it goes. In the third age, money itself becomes a god. The fourth age, we create deserts and ride on. Pray for us who once too thought we could fly. A little dystopian flavor in a Margaret Atwood story. Time capsule.
Well, we are seeing money out of control right now.
Yes.
It's completely out of control. It has a whole online existence that nobody seems to be able to get hold of.
Lee in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Margaret. This is just a comment about genre specifically. I recently graduated from college, and I was able to attend a university that didn't stick to the canon so precisely as I think some other schools do. And I think that speculative fiction and fantasy and sci-fi all hold, or at least I hold them all in great esteem, and I think that they do still have a stigma attached to them. But the sort of the interesting part about this is that I think a lot of authors who may have found themselves on the margins in, you know, the earlier part of the century, for whatever reason, because of their sex, because of their race, I think they're looking at sci-fi and speculative fiction, sort of these fringe genres, as a medium for discussing these issues of social class that was discussed earlier. And I just think that that's really important. I think that more contemporary authors need to start embracing this genre, because I think it's going to have a lot of weight in the future of literature.
Margaret, I wish you'd come right in here, and I thank you, Lee, but you've written a lot about this. I mean, And again, this kind of jumps off Ursula Le Guin saying, talking about you, saying you don't want the, she, you, don't want the literary bigots to shove her into the literary ghetto of sci-fi. What about this legacy of a kind of hierarchy of finer forms?
Okay, first of all, the British Library just had a huge retrospective of science fiction. Now, the British Library is not a fringe institution.
No.
So that's taking this and putting it right in the middle. Number one. Number two, the big read in New York right now is Ursula K. Le Guin, and I'm giving the keynote for that tonight. Again, this is not a part of the fringe. Ray Bradbury is being honored right now with a collection of stories to which a number of authors are contributing, and he is increasingly seen as one of the formative writers of the 20th century. So I would even dispute the fact that this is any more a fringe type of thing, and you would be hard put to get through a course on 20th century literature without encountering Orwell and Huxley.
And yet you write, as Ursula does here, where she talks about the literary ghetto, about the history of this kind of struggle to...
it did have this... it had this life in the late 20s and during the 30s and 40s of pulp magazines were a place where a lot of those writers found their home. And they were called pulps because they were made out of pulp paper. It didn't have a shiny coat on it. Magazines where the paper did have a shiny coat were called the slicks. So there were the pulps and the slicks. And the pulps quite frequently had very lurid, sexually provocative covers on the magazines, whereas the slicks were more inclined towards Saturday Evening Post and Good Housekeeping and were more family-oriented. So things like Weird Tales, for instance, that would be a pulp. And a lot of the early 20th century sci-fi writers published in those magazines. So probably that's where some of that reputation came from.
But there was also the kind of privilege given to what you call the rounded characters of the novel, as opposed to science fiction characters where they were clearly driven by a kind of agenda to tell a particular story or deliver a particular warning or paint a particular future, that roundedness versus...
Well, there are, in general, two kinds of fiction, and one would be called a romance, and that would be all adventure stories, and the other is thought of as the novel proper, which has concerned itself with depictions of society as it is. So science fiction would be in the first category. Remember, they were originally called scientific romances, not scientific novels. So the novel and the romance, the sci-fi has generally tended to be on the romance side of the equation. And they are more plot-driven. The characters are more patterned. And that is just a characteristic of that kind of fiction. But you could take another look and you could say, well, there's really only two kinds of books, those that are well-written and those that are not. And nothing else really, really matters from a readability point of view.
What about their function in our minds, in our cultures? Science fiction versus this more rounded character world of...
Well, romance in general is closer to myth. So you're going to be a lot closer to figures who verge on the supernatural. Dracula, for instance, would be in the romance genre. Anything with werewolves in it, similar. But that doesn't mean that you can't have well-done examples of any kind of book. You could, for instance, say that Pride and Prejudice is very similar to a lot of Harlequin romances as far as what kind of story it is, what happens in it, how it ends with the marriage. But it happens to be very well written.
How do you compare the relative weight or impact of these different genres?
On whom?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe... on society, on the individual? Is one aimed at the individual and their own kind of psychological perspective on relationships, and the other's aimed at sort of...
Okay, let's talk about age groups.
Okay, there's that, yes.
Oh, kids of reading age, when they come into reading, and when they come into writing, they're going to be probably much more inclined to be interested in something with dragons, wands, and magicians, or on the other hand, dinosaurs, monsters, and spaceships, than they are in a discussion of the home life of Mr. and Mrs. Brown. And because that is the age that they are.
Or Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, as you write.
But Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice is going to be of more interest to adults who may have had relationships like that and know what the author is talking about. Kids live in a very vivid universe in which there are all kinds of strange things under the bed. So they're going to bond a lot more quickly with something of the Harry Potterish nature.
Of course, there's a lot of science fiction for quite grown-up people. I mean, which do you think is more effective in alerting us to where we sort of are in the arc of human existence?
Okay, well, this is the problem with lumping everything in as science fiction, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So is Harry Potter science fiction? No, it's a wonder tale.
Fantasy, wonder tale.
Does it have the things in it that don't exist? Yes. Does that mean it's the same as science fiction? No. Is Dracula got something in it that doesn't exist? We certainly hope so. Is it science fiction? No. Does it alert us to the dangers of our society? No, unless you go out to bars and meet a lot of strangers quite frequently. So it's not, these books don't all perform the same function. And books called science fiction don't all perform the same function. Some of them are serious literary exercises and others are escapist fantasy. And they all get called science fiction and put on the shelf labeled science fiction.
I read you saying that those at the more serious end of that scale have quite a substantial impact on the way we understand.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question that you cannot immerse yourself for very long in 1984 and come out the other end thinking that a totalitarian dictatorship would be a good thing.
I almost hear you saying, you don't come out and say it, but that there may, in fact, these days almost be more important in terms of people raising their heads up and looking at scientific and political realities.
Well, I think that kind of writing can project things that are happening right now, take them a bit further, and show some of the possible consequences of them.
You've written across such a huge spectrum, and we've got a listener here, Eric, asking about that. He says, as a writer who's produced works in so many medium or genre, is there one that you prefer over the other? Is there one you feel most representative of yourself or your natural inclination to write? Is there more enjoyment in writing poetry or fiction, which you're most proud of? And I would make the speculative fiction distinction and put it in there as well. Is there one where you're most at home or most feel most accomplished?
Well, I can think of ones where I'm least at home and least accomplished. Let's start from the
All right.
that end. I've never written a play. I think that would take a lot of very specialized talent and probably a life in the theater to be able to do that at all well. I wrote in a number of different forms because nobody told me not to. I never went to a creative writing class or school where they often tell you have to pick one or the other and specialize in it. So I just really wrote what I felt like writing at the time.
And when you look back across that, I guess to Eric's question, having worked in so many different streams, which is the, can you do you have a hierarchy of favorites or?
Well, I don't really, although I realize that's probably a mistake and that I should take a lot of the online advice being handed out about defining your brand. You know, maybe I should have defined my brand.
I think it's worked out all right for you in any case.
I think it's worked out all right.
is it different weather that makes you sit down in the morning to think, you know, a kind of a Handmaid's Tale thought versus some intimate bit of poetry or headlines in the newspaper that turns you one way or the other?
It all gets into it, but it really starts something like, I don't think I should write this book. I think people are going to yell at me a lot and think I'm crazy if I do this. On the other hand, it's pretty tempting.
Will we see you?
So it goes like that.
Yeah, we see you in short story back in speculative fiction. Will we ever see you write all the way out in pure science fiction land, do you think?
You mean other planets and spaceships?
Well, wherever you draw the line.
Well, I've said I'm not good at that. So I'm not good at plays. And I'm not good at that kind of Star Trek science fiction, although, as I said, I'm a consumer of it. I just can't do it.
You do plenty on this side of that, and we're really grateful for it. Margaret Atwood's new book is In Other Worlds, SF and the Human Imagination, joining us today from New York. Margaret Atwood, thank you very much. It's been great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.